Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. I'm Tyler Tischler, Associate Editor with Reader Views Incorporated.
And I'm Victor Volkman from Loving Healing Press in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's September 13th, 2007, and welcome to episode number 41 in our series. Tonight's topic is editing your work and working with an editor. And our special guest who will be joining us this hour is Bob Rich from bobswriting.com. You can learn more about our guest on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. Now, before I begin, I'd like to thank our special guest co-host, Tyler Tischler, for filling in while Irene is on vacation. Tyler is author of Superior Heritage, which is part of a trilogy spanning 150 years of life on the shores of Lake Superior, and he is also the owner of Marquette Fiction. Now, tonight we're speaking with Bob Rich, a writer, editor, and psychologist living in Wombat Hollow, Australia. Bob is the author of more than a dozen books on a wide range of topics, including the Earth Garden Building book, Design and Build Your Own House, now in its fourth edition, Woodworking for Idiots Like Me, Cancer, A Personal Challenge, and many others. Four of them have won international awards. Now, in addition to writing, he has been a professional editor since 1999, working his way through two books in an average week. He has worked on everything from abstruse PhD theses and graduate textbooks to children's picture books and all genres of fiction. Bob's services are used by several independent publishers, including Loving Healing Press. However, most of his work is from writers wanting to polish their work before submitting to an agent or publisher or heading out to do self-publishing. And they come to him through personal recommendations from happy clients. He does both line editing and content editing. And what I like best about Bob is how he applies his deep knowledge and study of human psychology to each editing project. Good evening, Bob.
Well, it's good morning here, but hi. And I'm blushing.
Well, we're thrilled to have you, Bob. I think you're our first guest from outside of the United States, and we really appreciate your taking the time, and despite the time difference there in Australia, to join us today. We wanted to get started by asking you about editing, of course. It's a topic I know lots of authors have questions about. And the first question I wanted to start with was many authors, actually, they spend a lot of time and money already just in writing their books. And especially if they're going to self-publish their books, they have to spend all that extra money for the printing costs. So what would you say to them if they're wondering if getting an editor is really just an unnecessary added cost for them?
It's like saying that because you spent all that money buying a car, you really shouldn't spend any more money on sending it for regular maintenance. And that's my answer to that one. It's essential. Well, you can either do the work for yourself, in which case all you need is a second line, which another competent person, not necessarily paid for, and that's where I am. When I have written the book, I will find another person whose work I admire and respect, and I offer a trade. I'll look over your book, you look over mine, and we'll find each other's mistakes, typos, points of growth, whatever. But when I was starting in the writing world three times, I hired a professional editor. And each time I learned an enormous amount, and not only that book was improved, but my writing skills were improved. And that's my approach too. When I work on somebody's book, I feel myself to be as much a teacher as just a mechanical mistake finder.
Okay, well, what would you say to people who are, they're ready to send the book off to the publisher, and they're concerned about why should they pay up front to have the book edited? If the book is traditionally published, won't the publisher actually take the time to edit it anyway? And shouldn't they leave that decision up to the traditional publisher?
Well, one statistic, Penguin Australia gets 3,000 submissions through agents or whatever. They get 3,000 submissions, of which they can publish a few hundred books. I think American publishers have even a worse ratio. So if you want to have a hope of even having your second page read, then that first page has to be excellent. And all the way through, basically publishers have to look for reasons why they can reject the book, because there's so many excellent books to choose from. So anything that's halfway to not being excellent hasn't got a hope. All right, so then there are agents. Agents are the gatekeepers to publishers of necessity because of this great flood of work. But they're in the same position. They will get hundreds of submissions a week, and they have to sort through. So the slightest departure from excellence, and they'll look at something else. You've got to make your work as professional, as perfect as possible before sending it off.
Okay, I think that's a great way of looking at it, especially that they really have to find a reason to reject the book. And, you know, if they pick it up and they find lots of typos in it and lots of sentence problems, sentence structure issues, then they right away have a reason to reject the book. So you really are, in a sense, selling the book to the publisher or to the agent before they ever are able to sell the book to the reader.
Mm.
Is there a certain kind of a style manual that a person, if they're going to try to actually self-edit themselves, or are there any tips that you would suggest for somebody who does want to try to self-edit their book before, just as the first run, before sending it off to somebody else to do the editing?
Before I answer the question, it's not only typos and grammatical problems and misuse of words that you've got to look for, but things like author lectures and too much description, or all your characters speaking the same. All the subtle ways, and this applies even to non-fiction as well as to fiction. Everything has to read well, get the reader in. Basically, you want the reader to forget that this is reading a book. You want the reader to be in the content. And that means that you've got to use tricks of the trade to achieve that, to make the language invisible, to make the presentation invisible. And that's where the skill lies. And in answering your previous one, I've forgotten what the question was.
Well, I was just asking you if there was a certain type of,
Yes, there is a Chicago style manual, and there is Strunk and White, and they're good for people starting out. But look, when you're riding a bicycle, you can't learn it from reading a book on riding bike. You can read the instructions, and you get on the bicycle and start wobbling around, have a few falls, and after a while you're competent. So basically, you've got to get yourself to the point where it's intuitive and automatic, like with any skill. I would hate to be operated on by a surgeon who has to read the manual on it while doing the operation. So thesaurus, dictionary, style manual, they're great tools for learning the task, but not for doing it. And of course, the only way to learn is by doing. In my case, I've written 3 books which have never seen the light of day. I've just tossed them away. They were learning experiences. The 4th book I wrote was published. Now, other people are better at it. They start with a book that actually becomes a top bestseller. But generally, you've got to have learning experience. And short story writing is a very good tool for that. Or if you want to go into nonfiction, then writing nonfiction articles for your local newspaper. This kind of experience is very good for polishing up skill.
Okay, Bob. Given, you know, in that everyone is writing in instant messages and emails these days, often without benefit of punctuation, how much importance is there to sticking with the traditional forms?
Email is a form of conversation. So is instant messaging. They're asynchronous. You know, one person sends and sometime later another person receives and then sometime later sends back. But it's just conversation. Now, if I'm chatting with you, I will be using different terms of phrase, ungrammatical sentences, all sorts of things, and it's quite all right. If I get up on a stage to address an audience, I will be much more careful about my choice of words. It's quite different. So chatting with somebody is different from writing, and therefore the language you use is different. I would never dream of correcting somebody's email if there's a typo in it. But if somebody sends me a piece of writing, then of course that's my job to make corrections.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's all about the context, isn't it? Now, I know there's different types of editing. I mentioned a copy editing and line editing before, and I think there might even be something called developmental editing. What's the various spectrum of editing, and how do I know what I need?
If a book is basically ready for publication, content is as good as it can be, than what it needs as a proofread. That's line editing. That picks up punctuation mistakes, misspellings, typos, malapropisms, that is one word used instead of another, P-H-E-R-E instead of P-H-I-E-R, that kind of thing, awkward sentences, expression. However, often people send me stuff for line editing, and I end up making so many recommendations for content changes that the book needs a rewrite. You can ask Victor about that. I do that all the time. because if I've put my name to a book, even if nobody but the author and the publisher know that I've been involved in the book, I want that book to be as good as possible. I wouldn't like my name to be associated with some shoddy piece of work. So money is not that important to me. Excellence is much more important. And also being there as a service to others. So if somebody pays me for line editing, I'll still make content suggestions. Content editing is, well, it depends on what the book is about. If it's fiction, it's things like plot line, how the subplots, if any, fit into with the plot, characters, character development, how the characters interact, the world that is created by the author. Because even if you're writing about your home neighborhood, you're still creating a new world. It may be very similar to the real world out there, but it still has to be brought to life. And of course, when you go to fantasy or science fiction, you're creating sometimes completely new worlds that are very strange. But you do have to create that world and bring it to life. So these are the kinds of things that content editing is involved with. And somewhere in between the two is style of writing. Each author eventually develops a voice. And, of course, one of my jobs is to make sure that I don't insert my voice, but to keep the author's. And each author will have a certain way of doing things, which is perfectly legitimate. If you read some of the good ones, Dick Francis writes quite differently from Stephen King, for example, and they're both excellent. But then there are things like description. Description should be invisible. If I realize I'm reading description, that's too much. It's got to be inserted in such a way that rather than having something described to me, I experience it. Thoughts can be too much. I once read a book by a very popular author whom I'm not going to name, which was one in a series. And he spent the first 37 pages recapping the past in the series, largely through having people muse about it, think about it. And I only kept reading that far because I was doing, I decided I would see how far he would go before anything happened. And I can tell you, when I got to the first bit of action, by then I was so bored, I put the book down anyway. And there was another book where, again, I won't name her. She was describing the inside of a cave. It was somewhere people live. And there were three pages of describing the furniture. And that was not long before I put the book down.
Yeah.
So description should be from within the point of view of a particular character and in little snippets and so on. There are these aspects that are very important. That's where the skill lies, and that's the difference between success and failure.
Yeah, that's a very telling point about over-describing. Heading over a little bit into nonfiction, do I need to find an editor that specializes in the type of nonfiction I'm writing? If I'm writing about auto mechanics, do I need to find an editor who's also a master mechanic?
I think there are two kinds of answer to that. One is that if you need to have the technical contents checked for accuracy, then you need an expert. That expert need not be a good writer. But if, for example, you put the car director in the wrong place for this model car, then it's a mechanic who will pick that up, or a car engineer, or whatever. But for the writing, it doesn't matter. I have edited a PhD thesis for a lady in Britain who is an internet artist, and I didn't know the first thing about it, and yet I could help her to translate it into English, which it wasn't. She's a very visual person. I help her with the words. I have a client who sent me several books who's a professor in Taiwan who writes about the theory of fantasy. And I know nothing about the theory of fantasy. I like reading it. I like writing it. But this kind of stuff, it might as well be about a completely different planet. No, it means nothing to me. But I could help her to correct the English. Similarly, I had been the editor of a textbook for sophomores on nanotechnology. This is physics, mathematics, chemistry. I know nothing about those topics. The last time I studied physics and chemistry was in 1962. But there were 9 authors and me, and I was an essential part of the team.
Oh, I think you made some really good points there, Bob, about especially about description. And I know lots of writers probably struggle with putting enough description in their books or not, or putting too much description in their books. I think I've read some of those books you were describing, actually. What do you do when it comes to dialogue? Do you have any difficulties that you find writers make in writing dialogue, and how do you edit dialogue to make it effective?
Okay, excellent question. Dialogue is the heart of either fiction or of journalism, you know, and creative nonfiction like biography. It is one of the essential components. Now, the first thing is there shouldn't be too much dialogue, unbroken. It becomes word ping-pong, and it shouldn't be too little. There is a balance. And how much, there's no saying how much. It has to be right for a particular situation. So what you want to do is to break up dialogue with little insertions, thoughts, physical feelings, emotional reactions, description, memories, whatever, just snuck in. So each one of these insertions is so small that you don't even notice, but they break up the work thing. The second thing is it's essential for the reader to know at all times who says what. If I have to stop and think, now who was that? Was it Joe or was it Jim? Then you've lost me. I'm out of the artificially created reality that I'm in the story. So this is one of the reasons why it's important for each person to have a characteristic way of speaking which suits that person's personality. And here is where you can use the little insertions. You know, if I just say, he scratched his nose and then slowly got out, and then whatever he was saying, then one of the little messages is that the person speaking is not the one whose point of view we are in. So that's a little clue as to who is speaking. If there are two guys and I'm presenting the theme from the point of view of one of them, and obviously that one is the listener at the moment. And there are lots of little things like this that you can include.
Oh, that's a great answer.
And we'll be back with more Authors Access after these important announcements.
Whether you have already written your manuscript or are contemplating writing one, you will need to create a book proposal. ReaderViews has a coaching service to help you create an enticing book proposal for your work of fiction or nonfiction. In fact, ReaderViews will even submit your book proposal to publishers and agents they have created a relationship with, and then they promise to pursue these submissions. Go to ReaderViews.com today and click on Services for Authors to find out more information on book proposals and how ReaderViews can help you.
Did you ever hear that old saying, what you don't know won't hurt you? Well, when it comes to medical tests and medical decision-making, the more you know, the more power you have. This week on AuthorsAirwaves.com, Sue Vogan interviews Dr. Oleg Resnick, author of The Secrets of Medical Decision-Making. Dr. Resnick has experience in all phases of medicine, from the emergency room through end-of-life care, and he'll explain to us how you can make a difference in healthcare for yourself and your loved ones this week on AuthorsAirwaves.com. Music for Authors Access is provided by George Wood from PodSafeAudio.com. Now back to our interview with editor Bob Rich from BobsWriting.com.
One more point there, the word said. Many writers have a great deal of struggle with the word said, he said, she said. These things are called tags. Now, the first thing is if your writing is good enough, you'll need very few tags. They should be minimized. The fewer tags you have, the better. You should use tags to minimize ambiguity. I have to know, as a reader, who is speaking at all times, like I said, and sometimes the only way is by including a tag. Now, that tag should not be so fancy that it attracts attention to itself. So, I asserted, or something, is just so artificial that it's ridiculous. You know? So often the words, if you must have a pig, the word said is okay, except that you must always eliminate as much repetition as possible. So you don't want a page with five or six heads on it. One or two is enough. And it is okay to say he almost cried, yeah? Or he whispered, or he shouted. But again, you don't want to self-consciously and deliberately avoid said so much that the reader starts looking for said, either counting them because there are too many, or counting them because there are so many others. When is the said coming up, you know? You want to do anything to avoid attracting attention to language away from content.
Yeah, absolutely. That was going to be my next question about the dialogue tag. So you absolutely read my mind there. So I think instead what I'll ask you is, can you just kind of give us a little bit of a walkthrough of the process a writer would go through when they decide their book is ready to be edited? How do they go about finding an editor?
You go to Google or one of the search engines, and you write in editing or editing services, and you'll get some hits. You should go to a website called Creditors and Editors, and I'll have to look up the... I haven't got it handy. Sorry. But if you do a search for Creditors and Editors, that's an excellent website that lists the sharks, the people out there to trap the unwary. And the other thing is there are a great many email lists for writers. If you go to a thing like Yahoo Groups or one of those and you search for groups on writing, you'll find lots. And there again, you get word of mouth about who is good and who will rip you off. And in fact, I get much of my work by satisfied clients going to one of these writing groups and saying they like my work, and then I get three or four queries out of that.
What if somebody wanted to become an editor? What qualifications do you need to be an editor, or what qualifications would a writer look for in finding an editor?
The best qualification is suck it and see. When somebody approaches me, I ask them to send me the first 1,000 words of their book. I do a free edit on it, and I keep a time on the clock. So depending on how long it took me and how much of a sense I've got about this person's competence, I will then give a quote. So many dollars per 1,000 words. And I send back the free edit, and the person can look at what I have done, and they're either impressed or they're not. So the qualifications can be important. Many people go and do a suitable degree at university, and that's fine. It doesn't actually qualify them to be a good editor any more than a medical degree qualifies you to be a good doctor. You know? But it's certainly a good preparation. Other people work for years as journalists, or they work for a publisher, or, as in my case, have had years of writing and then entering in competitions and getting feedback in various ways, being part of groups where you critique each other's work, critique groups, and you learn in this way. In my case, I stumbled into editing by accident.
Okay, Bob. Do you need to like a book in order to do a good job editing it? I mean, can you disagree with the opinion and still hold a neutral attitude?
I have edited quite a few books I hated. It's a professional attitude. Again, going back to the doctor, if you help your patient, it helps, but surely you help everybody. I have edited erotica, which I hate. I think it's stupid. Some of it is disgusting. And I think the philosophy behind it depersonalizes. But I have done a competent work. Someone sent me the book, which was a publisher who was a regular client. I edited the book, did the best I could to make it the best of its kind that I could, and that's that. I wouldn't read a book like that. I certainly didn't enjoy it, but I did an honest job of it. And I think any professional will do the same.
Great. Then how does editing differ from criticism?
Oh, completely. Criticism is someone, or even a critique, someone sends me a book, and I will write back a couple of pages, maybe at the most, where I say, this is what I liked about your book, this is what I didn't like. That's if you're a good critic. If you're a bad critic, you just say, this is what I didn't like. But I like the Toastmasters way of doing an assessment, which is a sandwich. You find all the good things you can, then you make suggestions for improvement, and you finish with a compliment. And that's how I approach a critique. In editing, you go through and you, well, in my case, I comment on the good things because I want to encourage the writer. And also, if I point out the good things, that's stuff that the writer can use to grow. If it works, do more of it. But my job, what I get paid for, is to find all the things that must be changed and all the things that I feel would improve the book if they were changed. All right, so every typo, comma out of place, wrong word used, awkward sentence, stuff like that, I've got to identify. And if I say, you know, really, if this character were a little bit more like more that way rather than this way, or in this dialogue, this character is not true to herself, I point out those things. So it's got to be exhaustive and sometimes exhausting.
Right. That leads me into a slightly bigger question. What are the kinds of things that you look for in a book? What makes something excellent over just run-of-the-mill?
Novelty, for a start. Given its genre, given what it's about, it's got to be different. It's got to have something unique to offer. You don't want the same old boilerplate put back again in a different place and different character. For example, I've got a friend, Brendan Wilson. I mean, I've never met him. He's in Hawaii, who does treks around the globe. He goes somewhere like Tibet, or the last one was from France to Jerusalem, and he walks. And he writes these wonderful books, and each one is different. So when I get one of his books, are you still there?
Yeah, we're still here.
Hello? I heard a funny noise. When I get one of his books, I actually have to watch that I concentrate on the editing because I get lost in the content. Another one is a science fiction writer, Darryl Bain. I've edited several of his books. It's the same thing. I've really got to watch. He gets me so in that I've got to be self-conscious about picking up the missing quotes and things like that. So that's a good book. The second thing is the author's job is to create a reality, put some characters into it, and then get out of the way, become invisible. To create a situation and then have the characters do all the work after that. And reading is actually a funny sort of a tradition. It's very different from watching a movie. In a movie, someone else has done the creativity and you sit down and take it in. In a book, basically, the author, like I said, sets things up. And it is then the reader whose job it is to be the director, the stage setter, and at least one of the characters, the character whose point of view we're following, and as well as the audience. So reading is a very creative exercise. This is, of course, fiction and creative non-fiction. In journalism or in non-fiction, it's an instructional. It's a bit different. Although even journalism, isn't it? You still have the journalist take you there. But in journalism, the point of view is always that of the writer.
Bob, what is the way that most people actually provide the proofs back for the text? Like, is it done on a computer screen? Do most people print out the pages and you actually make traditional proofreading marks on the paper now? Or does it vary from one editor to another?
Well, I don't even have a red pen. I do everything on screen. But everybody's different. I know some people who print it out. They get something by email and print it out. Now, I'm a conservationist, and I think in today's world, with all these disasters caused by climate change, you're either a conservationist or a suicide. But I've been conservationist since 1972. So I use as little paper as I can. When I must print something out, I do it on the back of something else. But people send me a book by email. I edit using track changes, send it unless the person wants a different arrangement. In other words, using colored text, you know. And I send it back, and it never sees paper. There's lots of advantages. In fact, nowadays, if I try editing on papers, it's unavoidable sometimes, I will miss things that I'll pick up on screen.
That's interesting. What are some of the biggest errors that you find, like the most common usage errors that you see in editing and that writers usually need the most work on?
Well, it depends with the writer. There is a whole generation, not only in America, who went through school without being taught grammar, spelling, or punctuation. So there are people who are very intelligent, have a lot to say, and they say it well, and they can't write for anything. They're functionally illiterate. and I come across a lot of them, with them, it's simply correcting the technical mistakes. And that drives me crazy. I actually charge more for work like that because I find it boring, difficult, repetitious, and I don't like it. And also, I mean, if you go to a mechanic and you see him starting to adjust your brake with a shifting spanner, I wouldn't take my car back there. So a craftsperson should be competent at using the tools, and our tools are language. So people should learn to be competent. So if a person is in that position, for heaven's sake, go and do a remedial course. It can be picked up. There are actually several writers who started like this, and I've edited several of their books, and now they're competent. So I acted as a teacher to them, and I was delighted to do it. But then, of course, beyond that, it depends on what kind of book we're talking about. If it's fiction, it's getting the elements of description, action, and dialogue right, how to mix them up, how to construct the plot, and so on. It's a technical aspect. In a non-fiction book, it is continuity, to make sure that each little section leads to the next one. All writing is like a chain. If you can think at any level, chapters each should lead to the next one and be joined together. Each chapter should be a self-contained piece of writing with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you should be able to summarize it in a single sentence. And then if that sentence is expanded, each section or scene or something within it should be describable in a single sentence. And in fact, one very good way of writing is actually to construct the plot or for non-fiction a structure, which is like that. But another way is an intuitive way of writing, an organic way, where you just set up a situation and see where it takes you. But even then, the principle of writing having to be a chain or a tree structure or something, it should emerge that way.
Well, I know what you were saying there, Bob, about the generation that didn't learn grammar. I taught English at the university level for many years, and I know grading papers could be quite frustrating when I had students that didn't know the basics of the English grammar. So my question for you is, how do you keep from getting burnt out on editing and re-editing pieces of work when there are so many problems that you have to work on?
Well, one of my standard—it's up on my website as a statement. Anybody who sends me a book should know this. If I get to a certain point and I find that I've found all this person's systematic mistakes, then I will send the edited part back and suggest a rewrite, and then I will work on the book when it's rewritten. So this way, I don't have to drive myself crazy, and the person doesn't have to pay for me saying the same thing over and over and over. But the other thing is that editing is not my main job. It's what I do in between other things. So often I will have half an hour or even 10 minutes. I'll do a few pages. And I work very fast because I speed read, which actually is more accurate than reading slowly. It's interesting. You're more likely to pick up mistakes by going fast and by going slowly and laboriously. Don't ask me to explain the psychology of it, but it's a fact, not only for me. But, you know, I'm doing psychological counseling. I sit down, client's gone. I've got a quarter of an hour before the next client comes. So I write up my case notes, read up on the next client. I've got 5 minutes. I'll do a page or two of an editing job. Client doesn't turn up, I've got an hour and a quarter to do it. And so it actually helps me to not feel frustrated. If I have to take a ride on a bus or a train, I'll take my notebook computer, and while the battery lasts, I'll be working. So it's something I weave in my day, in between other things.
Great, Bob. That sounds like a real interesting lifestyle you have with that. Let's remind our listeners what your websites are again. I know you've got several.
Well, the simple thing is you go to a search engine and just type in Dr. Bob Rich, but my main writing site is bobrich@bobswriting.com, so B-O-B-R-I-C-H as one word. Sorry, that's my email address. It's just bobswriting.com, so bobswriting.com. But I've also got other websites. I've got one called mudsmith.net, which is my conservation site, and my psychology website, which is anxiety and depression as one word, and -help.com. And I get lots of hits on that one, and every month I get somewhere between half a dozen to up to 20 desperate calls for help from people who just don't have anyone else to turn to. And I feel that's a privilege and an honor.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? All right. Well, I just want to thank you on behalf of Tyler and Irene, who couldn't be on this call tonight. And you've been really generous with your time and everything.
Well, it was my pleasure, and I enjoyed it. There is an Australian word which I think has made itself into the American, made its way into the American language. It starts with bull and ends with another word that you'll know. And I'm a storyteller. That is, I'm a bull, whatever it is, artist. So.
There you go. Straight from the horse's mouth, as we say in the U.S. You've been listening to another podcast edition of Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. We'll be back on the air September 20th, 2007, when our topic will be Writing for Social Change. And our guest who will be joining us is Anya Ochtenberg. You can learn more about all our guests on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. Authors Access is a joint production of Reader Views and Loving Healing Press.
For Reader Views, this is Tyler Tischler in Marquette, Michigan.
For Loving Healing Press, this is Victor Volkman in Ann Arbor, Michigan, wishing you all a good evening in the U.S. or a good day in Australia. Good night.